Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. Well, back from yesterday, I suppose. George W. Bush and Tony Blair yesterday lying to the world in a very calculated way. It's really quite striking, quite amazing, really, when you think about it. What they did, a very elegant political dance, and of course, the press in the room. We talked to Victoria. I talked to Victoria Jones about 2 hours ago. We'll have somebody from Talk Radio News Service on in the second hour of the program. Who will give us an update on this, but Victoria Jones was in the room in the second row of the press, you know, the bunch of press there to ask questions of Bush and Blair. And it was obvious, she said, that they were ready for the Downing Street memo question, that they knew that it was coming, and that they had rehearsed their response to it. Now, when I first heard this, when I first heard the response, I thought, you know, my first thought was, oh, my God, they're both going to just try and bluff their way through it. They're going to lie to us. And they're doing it. That was my first take on it. Then I went back and read the transcript. And what I realized was that, yes, there's a couple of lies in there. And the one in particular that surprised me the most. George Bush lying to me doesn't surprise me because he just routinely lies to the American people. But Tony Blair lying, repeating the big lie, that surprised me. And it's going to be really interesting to find out if the British press lets him get away with this. I have a feeling they won't. And you know, the question is, how much, you know, how deep in into this thing is Tony Blair? Does he have any possibility of pulling himself out? Is there any possibility that he can redeem himself, that he can pull back from his association with George Bush? Because I think that, frankly, the only thing that's going to save Tony Blair politically is to throw Bush to the wolves. And I can't figure out why he hasn't done it yet. He keeps coming back. He keeps coming back to the White House and saying, please, Mr. Bush, spank me again. I mean, you know, go figure. He comes back and he says, please give us aid to Africa. And Bush says, okay, fine, we'll give you $900 million worth of aid to Africa. But you already allocated that. Well, that's what you're going to get. And it's painful to watch. It's speaking as an American, and I know we have British listeners, and I, in fact, if one of my British listeners has some clue as to what's going on and can illustrate and can illuminate me on why Blair would go along with this, I'd love to hear from you. Our number, if you're calling from outside the United States, 503-248-0620. Area code 503-248-0620. And our toll-free number, of course, 866-889-8894. And if you don't want to drop into our live chat room, you can go to TomHartman.com and just click live chat and it'll get you in there. So let's just review the events of yesterday, the big lie participation. This just truly, truly mind-boggling to me. Here, first of all, a reporter from the Washington Post, who I've been so far unable to figure out exactly who he is. I'm sure his name will come out. But apparently from the Washington Post, standing up, asking this question. And in fact, if you watched the press conference, it was like they knew the question was coming. They knew the guy that they wanted to ask it, and they had rehearsed their answers. Here's the question, because Blair just leaped right in there. Oh, we're ready to go on that one, boy. Here's the question and the first part of the answer.
On Iraq, the so-called Downing Street memo from July 2002 says intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy of removing Saddam through military action. Mm-hmm. Is this an accurate reflection of what happened? Could both of you respond?
Well, I can respond to that very easily. No, the facts were not being fixed in any shape or form at all.
Now, see, keep in mind. Whoops,
Street memo,
excuse me here.
July 2002 says intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy of removing Saddam through military.
Try it again.
Is this an accurate reflection of what happened? Could both of you respond?
Well, I can respond to that very easily. No, the facts were not being fixed in any shape or form at all.
Now, this is Blair speaking for himself. And the Downing Street memo did not say that Blair was fixing the facts. It said that Bush was fixing the facts. So here's Tony Blair saying, no, speaking for myself, we're not fixing any facts, and the UK wasn't. As far as we can tell, they were believing, Doug Feith, Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, the guys who were stovepiping the intelligence and fixing it. So anyhow, there's the beginning of Blair's comment.
And let me remind you that that memorandum was written before we then went to the United Nations.
In other words, all the more reason to impeach George Bush, because that memorandum was written saying that Bush had already decided to go to war before we went to the UN. Blair doesn't explain why he said that. And oddly, Bush even echoes it like it's some sort of justification. But anyhow, Blair continues.
Now, no one knows more intimately the discussions that we were conducting as two countries at the time than me.
Now, this is where we get into the rehearsed lie, and that is, well, George and I were talking, and George wasn't telling me that he fixed the intelligence. And when you hear George's part of it, George Bush's part of it, George Bush Jr.'s part of it, you'll hear Jr. saying, well, I never told Tony, these things. Tony and I weren't fixing the intelligence. In other words, neither one of them actually responds to the question. Back to Blair.
And the fact is, we decided to go to the United Nations and went through that process, which resulted in the November 2002 United Nations resolution.
Now, here comes the big lie.
To give a final chance to Saddam Hussein to comply with international law. He didn't do so.
And there's the lie. Saddam Hussein did not comply with international law, says Blair. In fact, what Resolution 1441 called for was for Saddam Hussein to open his country to the weapons inspectors and to give documentation to the United Nations proving that he had destroyed his weapons of mass destruction. And he did. He provided them with 14,000 pages of documentation. We took 5,000 of those pages out and refused to let the rest of the United Nations see them because they were the pages that talked about when Rumsfeld was over there selling them weapons. I mean, it's mind-boggling when you think about it, really. 14,000 pages of documentation. Hans Blix running all over the country, checking things out. And in fact, later after the fact, somebody said to Hans Blix, how is it that the Bushies are still claiming that you were finding any evidence at all, that anything was going on? How is it that the Bushies were able to discover, how can they continue to claim this? And Blix compared the Bushes' belief in weapons of mass destruction in Iraq to the 14th century belief in witches. Here's Hans Blix.
In the Middle Ages, when people were convinced there were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is that he didn't have it, and therefore he didn't do it. So anyhow, back to Tony Blair. Tony Blair has just told the big lie that Saddam Hussein did not comply with the UN resolutions when, in fact, he did. Blair continues.
And that was the reason why we had to take military action.
Now notice the but. See, I think that Tony Blair, deep down in his heart of hearts, is not a pathological liar and is a fundamentally decent person. Now, maybe that's just because he has a British accent and I'm American. I don't know. But, that's my sense of it, that Blair is a decent guy and that he's having a really hard time dealing with a guy who just lies because it's convenient, at the drop of a hat. George Bush, any old answer that just happens to be a lie. So Blair continues.
All the way through that period of time, we were trying to look for a way.
Now this, again, he's talking about him and Bush. He's not talking about Bush having fixed the intelligence before this. So again, this is the calculated lie that they obviously had rehearsed before the fact.
Of managing to resolve this without conflict. As it happened, we weren't able to do that because, as I think was very clear, there was no way that Saddam Hussein was ever going to change the way that he worked or the way that he acted.
So Tony Blair ends with a soundbite, And see, both of them have been rehearsed to end with a soundbite because that's what the news will pick up and you'll hear on CBS. And so Tony Blair's soundbite was, there's no way Saddam was going to change. And George Bush's soundbite will be, and the world is better off without him. And those are the soundbites, right? And you know, they're probably irrefutable soundbites, but they have nothing to do with why 1,600 Americans are dead, why 100,000 Iraqis are dead, why the world hates us, why the Bush administration and the Blair administrations have painted a bullseye on the back of every American and British soldier in the world, not to mention American and British tourists. You know, it just doesn't address it. Oh, my. And we'll get to George Bush's response in just a minute. First, you know, I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on this. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to call in. If you're calling from outside the United States, 503-248-0620. Lynn in Beverly, Massachusetts on the line. Hey, Lynn.
Hi. How are you, Tom?
Great. What's up?
Well, I just have an opinion, and we know what they are, but regarding why it is that Blair keeps caving.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's caved since the get-go on all of these things, not
yes.
just this Downing Street memo.
Right.
And actually this kind of draws in Watergate a little bit. The reason these people are able to get away with these things is because of they have the goods on them. They're being bribed.
You mean blackmailed?
Blackmailed, yes.
So what are the goods that you think that Bush has on Blair?
Who knows? I mean, I could speculate that's all it would be.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's why he's able to blackmail him, is that it's not common knowledge.
Now, what Claire Short has suggested, or at least this is my understanding of it, and again, I'm not a keen observer of British politics, although I know in our chat room right now there's at least one or two people who are in Europe who may have different opinions, and I'll have to be reading that during the break and see what's being said.
So I'm curious to what they have to say
about
that.
Yeah, and I'll relate that. But my recollection is that what Claire Short was saying, or what people within Blair's cabinet were saying, was that the reason that Blair was telling them why he had to toady up to George Bush was because George Bush was crazy. And that if the British didn't participate with Bush in this thing in Iraq, then it was going to go terribly, terribly bad. That Blair could talk Bush into going to the UN. He could essentially force him to go to the UN. And that therefore he might get slowed down or stopped. And that there might be a peaceful resolution. Whereas if Blair didn't participate in it, then all hell would break loose and we might even have World War III and the whole Muslim world hating us. And then Blair, of course, you know, he cut the deal with the devil. I mean, you know, once you get halfway into it, you just can't stop. And so now he's trying to cover his butt. He's trying to, you know, this is where I said, I think he ought to say, hey, wait a minute, I've been lied to all this time. I'm over it. No more of this with George Jr.
But his excuse, as you described it, his excuse, as you described it, sounds like someone who is being blackmailed. On one side of the fence, and you go to the other side of the fence, and you have to explain it away.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. And it may be, Lynn, that you're right.
Hey, just think about Hoover.
Yeah,
that's
right.
How he had so much power.
You're right. J. Edgar Hoover had the goods on everybody, and he used it. He used it mercilessly to blackmail a series of American presidents. So maybe that Bush has something on Blair. I think it's just the fear of politicians of admitting that they were wrong, because that's often political suicide. 20 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And I'm taking my country back.
It's time.
Ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. So I'm taking my country.
Oh, what a fine plan. Times.
We had a bundle in the treasury drawer, more than there had ever been before. But every day we're down and deeper in debt. Maybe 4 years should be all you get. Then you gave tax breaks to the millionaires, and you tried to make the working man pay. But you can't tax a man when his job's not there. Now look at where we are today.
Today, yeah, I'm taking my country back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 26 minutes past the hour. We're talking about George W. Bush and his press conference last night with Tony Blair. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Donald in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Hey, Donald.
Hey, hey, Tom. I just wanted to call in about, kind of about the memo. I mean, everybody is looking towards Bush and Blair, but the person I think is most responsible is Colin Powell, because, you know, before he came out for the war, you know, I just think his support, everybody respected him. And
are you military? Are you?
Yeah, I'm in the Army.
Fort Bragg, that would be 82nd Airborne?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, Colin Powell, I'm curious what the military take on this is, because Colin Powell is highly respected and has been, not just by the American people, but certainly by the American military. Is the consensus among the folks that you know, and I realize you can't speak for the Army or anything like that, or for all, you know, vets or whatever, you know, people in the armed services, but is the consensus that Powell was duped, or that Powell became part of the conspiracy to dupe us?
Well, I'll be honest. Most of my friends in the military, you know, they're for the war, and they're, you know, that any take they have on it would be, you know,
they've been listening to Limbaugh on Armed Forces Radio.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's just my personal take on it.
Okay.
You know, so.
And so what's your personal take on it? Do you think that Powell was duped, or do you think that Powell got in on the conspiracy and duped us intentionally?
Well, I just think they pressured him. I think he knew exactly what he was doing, and that's why I hold him more responsible than, because everybody respected him, and I really believe that without him, we wouldn't have gone to war.
And he caved in. Yeah, well said, Donald. Thank you a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Jim in Indianapolis on the line. Hey, Jim.
Yeah, Tom, this Downing Street memo, I mean, there's nothing new here, man. I mean, Bush is going to lie. He's been lying since the day he was the governor of Texas, you know, and the reporters are all scared to death to ask the guy a question with any substance at all.
Well, he was lying when he was a business. He was lying to the people of Texas about the stadium. I mean, you know, he was lying about when he sold his stock and he had inside stock tradings. I mean,
the guy lies like a Persian rug every day of his life, and that's all he's all about. You know, on a weekly basis, I'm a truck driver. I call every major news outlet that has a TV outlet for news and beg these people to report the real news. Stop canceling the real news, putting on this garbage, and let's. I said, when are you going to, I asked CBS, I said, when are you going to take in after this administration? This administration is nothing but a pack of thieves and liars, man. I've been alive 58 years. I've never seen anything like it in all of my born days, ever. And the guy at CBS finally told me, he said, all I can tell you, Jim, is it's being worked on. I said, well, I'll tell you, I hope one of these magazine shows that you have, that we're going to see the bombshell that needs to be put out for the public consumption, because the people are walking around in a fog and they still don't understand how bad this administration really is, Tom.
Yeah. Well, Jim, if it's any consolation, remember Watergate came out before an election and was completely ignored. And, you know, it took a year for the Watergate story to really percolate up. And of all the scandals of this Bush administration, I think this one, because it involves actually Bush lied and hundreds of thousands, at least 100,000 humans have died now as a result of it, including, you know, 1,600 Americans. I think it's going to bite him in the butt. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Now you don't know my name, but you know who I am. I'm your everyday work hard, play hard, raise kids and pray hard, common man. And Lord knows I love this land. That's why I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed. Taking my country back. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. It's time to take our country back. Yeah, you say you're a nighter, but you divide us more. This is just incredible.
And fly. I'm taking my country back.
I love it. I love it. Welcome back, my friends. It's Tom Harbin. 25 minutes before the hour. Just a quick sound bite here. A quick thought. Before we go back to the telephone lines, our telephone number, by the way, 866-889-8894, from a former president of the United States. I think it's apropos to this moment. Here is Harry S. Truman on March 29th, 1952. Harry Truman.
These Republican gentlemen can't have it both ways. They can't be for morality on Tuesday and Thursday, and then be for special privileges for their clients on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Well, I don't think the black is white campaign of the Republican Party is going to succeed. I think the voters are going to see through this holier-than-thou disguise that our Republican friends are putting on.
Yeah, and I think that that is actually happening. I really do. I get this sense that these guys, you know, they have blown it. They have blown it. We're going to hear from George Bush lying to us in just a moment. First, let's take a few phone calls. Julie in Madison, Wisconsin on the line. Hey, Julie, what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
Just a quick thing today. I'm always calling the White House comment line.
Uh-huh.
I was telling them about the Downing Street memo and that I'm really encouraging everybody to get on johnconyers.com and sign the petition for the inquiry.
Right.
And never have they ever engaged me in conversation, but the woman asked me, well, what is that memo? And so I explained to her and told her what it was all about. And it was really encouraging because that was the first time ever calling the White House comment line that someone actually, as a citizen, asked me what the information I was trying to convey.
The operator didn't know the answer.
The operator.
Which is a sad commentary on the state of our media. There was a bunch of people down, I'm broadcasting from Portland, Oregon right now, and the Oregonian, which is the newspaper, it's basically like the statewide newspaper, you know, it's the big newspaper, it's the big Portland paper, and there were a couple of people protesting 2 days ago, out in front of Monday morning, in front of the Oregonian, they had a big protest sign that said, "Oregonian, please publish the memo," because they hadn't run a story that actually published the text of the memo in it. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, no major newspaper has. I interviewed afterwards one of the folks who was involved in this protest, and he said that, you know, there were people driving by and honking and giving them thumbs up and, you know, waving them on and saying, you know, good job, keep it up. But he said the most common response that he got in the 3 hours they were there, and it must have been from at least 50 people, was, "What memo are you talking about?"
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tragedy. I mean, that is the absolute tragedy.
We love you, Tom, and keep up the great work, because you're doing fantastic.
Thanks, Julie. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Thank you for your kind words. 1-866-889-8894. Randy in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Randy.
Hi, Tom. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you.
I just had an idea I'd like to throw out and see what you think. I think that we should drop Columbus Day as a federal holiday. It could still be observed, but in its place, we could have Election Day as a federal holiday.
Well, that was Howard Dean's point when he said that he said he couldn't figure out why the Republicans were fighting against having Election Day be a federal holiday, unless it was the fact that they didn't have to worry about going to work.
If you drop Columbus Day, then you don't add any more to the debt because you just trade one holiday for the other.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good plan. The problem, Randy, is that the day for the elections, which is the first Tuesday in November, is fixed in the Constitution. So that would require a constitutional amendment, and constitutional amendments are really, really hard. They have to get through both houses of Congress with a two-thirds majority, and then they have to be ratified by three-quarters of the states. And it takes years, and it's difficult, and I think that there are probably solutions short of that. For example, here in Oregon, everybody votes by mail. And Oregon has the highest voter participation in the nation because everybody votes by mail. And there's an absolute paper trail because you mail in a ballot. It's got your name on it. It's got you, who you are. I mean, you know, the ballot doesn't have your name. The envelope does. But you know, there is your ballot, and it can be counted, and it's a physical piece of paper, and it can be subject to a recount, and there's just no question about it. And, in fact, the state of Washington, just north of us, is looking very seriously at doing vote by mail because they just had this thing where the governor, Gregoire, was attacked by Dino Rossi, the Republican, for voting fraud, of all things. A Republican claiming that a Democrat is engaging in vote fraud. amazingly enough. Anyway, I want to get back to George Bush here. Here's Bush yesterday lying to the American people. And again, you can tell how carefully rehearsed this was. When you listen, there's one point where he says, no, we didn't fix the intelligence. He had to say that. Because, you know, with the big lie strategy is you try to, you know, you try and knock it down, right? You just knock down the rumor or whatever, put out the lie. He had to say that, but he spent most of the time actually doing the waffle, doing the small lie, which is the memo was about how within the Bush administration, they had already decided to go to war and they were fixing the intelligence to match the policy, to quote the memo or paraphrase the memo. But Bush, instead of talking about that, talks about his conversations with Blair. Well, of course now, and Blair, in his discussion, was talking about his conversations with Bush. And we know now, or we have a pretty good idea now, that Bush was lying to Blair. And Blair, you know, apparently, as of July 2002, had figured out that Bush was lying to him, but had to maintain some level of what John Kennedy referred to as plausible deniability. Remember when Bobby Kennedy was running an off-the-shelf operation to assassinate Fidel Castro, and John Kennedy didn't want to know about it because he had to be able to plausibly deny it, you know, to the press and to Congress if it ever came to a criminal investigation. Same thing with Richard Nixon and some of the plumbers' activities. He'd say, you know, you guys do what you're going to do, but don't tell me about it because I don't want to have to lie about it. So I think that Blair was in that same situation, and that's why he's very carefully talking about his conversations with Bush, not what the content of the memo was. And then Bush is doing the same thing. Here's George Bush responding to this.
Well, I read kind of the characterizations of the memo, particularly when they dropped it out in the middle of his race.
So that's the, you know, step one.
They dropped it out either, but I'm not suggesting that you all dropped it out there.
Yeah, in other words, it was a political. So the first thing that Bush tries to say is, it's just politics. It's just politics. You got dropped out during a political race. You know, it's a campaign. It's just politics. Don't, you know, ignore that man behind the curtain. After all, we lied about John Kerry with the swift vote veterans. Bush saying that he lied about John McCain down in South Carolina when they were floating stories in South Carolina in the primary in 2000 that John McCain had a out of wedlock black child and that his wife had been treated for mental illness and that he was psychiatrically disabled as a consequence of having a prisoner of war. You know, people lie during election campaigns. That's how Bush looks at it. And so he says, it's just politics. That's his first response. And then he gets into his own little lie.
Somebody said, well, you know, we had made up our mind to go to use military force to deal with Saddam. There's nothing farther from the truth.
There's nothing farther from the truth. Yeah. So he doesn't. He didn't come out and say, we hadn't decided to, but he says, maybe in his world that's not a lie. I don't know. Positioning things locationally. But anyhow, he continues.
Conversations with the prime minister was, how can we do this peacefully?
See, there you go. Now he gets into my conversations with the prime minister. Now, that has nothing to do with the memo.
What could we do? And is this meeting, you know, evidently that took place in London, happened before we even went and... to the United Nations, or I went to the United Nations.
Yeah, now we have a justification, and George Bush just gave it to us, for impeachment. I mean, you know, if this is true, if these guys were fixing the intelligence to meet the policy before going to the UN, then, you know, there's your high crime and misdemeanor. I mean, this is, there it is, right there. This is before we went to the UN. He's confessing, sort of.
And so it's, both of us didn't want to use our military. Nobody wants to commit military into combat. It's the last option.
Now, this is where he's getting back into the, he's so compassionate thing that he was doing during his campaign. He'd go around and say, you know, and I'm comforting families. The hardest thing I have to do is comfort families. He won't talk to Pat Tillman's family. He won't talk to the families of people who think that their children died. Their sons, daughters, husbands, wives died for no good reason. He won't give them an answer. He won't meet with them. He won't allow them to even take pictures of the caskets coming back at Andrews Air Force Base. No. He had a few sanitized, you know, well-publicized meetings with Republican-supporting families of veterans who had died. People who really believed his lies. He had a couple of meetings with them, and I'm sure it was very difficult for him. If he actually has emotions, I'm sure if he's not a sociopath, I'm sure it was very difficult for him to deal with that, to actually confront them and deal with the pain that they were experiencing and the fact that they had lost their loved ones. But it was just a few people. But he's taken this little, you know, a couple of meetings that he had, one in particular, and blown them into this as if he comforts every family. I'm telling you, here in Oregon, the governor of Oregon, Ted Kulongoski, when the war first started, made the public commitment that he would attend every funeral. We're at 47 people dead in Oregon, and the governor has attended every single funeral, and it's starting to flip him out. There was a whole interview with him in the paper a week or so ago about how he's getting more and more religious in his eulogies because he's becoming overwhelmed by this, and it's the only way that he can deal with it. You know, dead body after 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 dead body. For what? So that the Republicans could take control of the Senate in 2002, which is why they rolled this thing out, the resolution, in September of 2002. And so that October and November they could use whoever voted against it and beat up on them in the campaigns. And they did, to take back the Senate. And they were successful in doing that. I mean, look at what happened to Max Cleland. This was the anti-Max Cleland strategy. Assuming that the vote wasn't rigged in Georgia, which I'm not convinced, you know, I'm pretty convinced, frankly, that the vote was rigged in Georgia, but that's a whole other thing. In any case, this was the anti-Max Cleland strategy, and then in 2004, George gets to be the war president. I'm the war president. So anyhow, back to Bush.
The consequences of committing the military are very difficult. You know, the hardest things I do as the president is to try to comfort families who've lost a loved one.
Oh, jeez.
In combat. It's the last option.
Yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't the last option. It was the first option. And Blair had to talk him into going to the UN. And even when he went to the UN and he got Resolution 1441, which said that the UN will only authorize force if Hans Blix or Mohammed al-Baradei say that, you know, that there is evidence of weapons of mass destruction, Bush had to leapfrog that because he knew that they were going to come back in 2 more weeks. And that's all Blix was asking for, was 2 more weeks. They were going to come back in 2 weeks and say, there's nothing there. There's no reason to go to war. You can just calm down and your soldiers will still be alive and your men and women will still have their arms and legs and eyes and ears, and there was, and 100,000 Iraqis won't be dead. And folks on the other side would say, yes, but a tyrant will still be in power. I'm sorry, there's tyrants in power in about 80 countries in the world. If our job is to go around and remove them, we're going to be, well, it's not our job. I mean, let's just say it. It's not our job. We don't have the resources. We don't have the time. We don't have the energy. We don't have the money. And it's not, I mean, the whole point of this, the founding of this country, George Washington's farewell address, avoid foreign entanglements. It's contrary to the American tradition. Bush continues.
That the president must have, and it's the last option I know my friend had as well.
Yeah, well, there he's speaking the truth. Tony Blair, apparently very upset about this.
And so we worked hard to see if we could figure out how to do this peacefully.
Yeah, in other words, Blair kept trying to talk him into being peaceful, and he kept saying, no, sorry, we're going to go to war. So we worked hard to try and figure. Yeah, see, again, he's talking about his conversations with Blair, not about the internal decisions made inside the United States government to fix the intelligence.
To put a united front up to Saddam Hussein, said the world speaks, and he ignored the world. Remember, 1441 passed the Security Council unanimously.
And you violated 1441. You went against 1441. 1441 said the United States may not attack Iraq until the UN says so, and the UN never said so, clearly and explicitly. And then George, of course, ends with a soundbite, because obviously both of them had rehearsed this, and with a soundbite so that the press will pick up the soundbite, and that's what CBS Evening News will run with, and NBC, you know, with Brian Williams, who says it's his duty to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day, that they will pick up that soundbite of, you know, the world is better off without Saddam Hussein. He was the one who made the decision, blah-de-blah.
He made the decision. And the world is better off without Saddam Hussein in power.
Yeah, I always end on a soundbite. This is the, you know, Frank Luntz's advice, and boy, are they following it and doing it well. Here, George W. Bush Jr. and Tony Blair, a.k.a. Tony Blair, lying to the American people, the British people. And how is this flying in, you know, how Zappa for Prez in the chat room says Goebbels taught them how to talk. Yeah, it was Goebbels who said, if you tell a big lie loud enough and often enough, the people will come to believe it. And this is what's happening. These guys are absolutely rewriting history. How can George Bush cite Resolution 1441 in the same breath that he's saying that he had some justification to attack Iraq, when 1441 says you can't attack Iraq unless the weapons inspectors say that there's a reason to attack Iraq? And the weapons inspectors kept saying, doesn't look like there's a reason. Which is the reason why Germany and France and Russia and China and the other members of the Security Council were saying, no, you can't do this. But Bush had to do it anyway. After all, they had to get the Republicans into the Senate. They had to get Bush reelected. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now I can understand why you were hot, 'cause Bin Laden never did get caught. So you said we had Saddam to blame, tried to tell us it was all the same.
Yeah, all right.
Now the years roll by and our kids keep dying. You don't even have a plan to bring them home. And those WMD you promised on TV, hey, admit it, you figured it wrong, so I'm taking my country back.
Our theme song for the day, Taking America Back. Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 4 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Bob in Tennessee on the line. Hey, Bob.
Hey, good afternoon. Say, I wonder, did you catch it? Bush almost told the truth.
Almost.
In the middle of, well, toward the end of his remarks, he said, started to say, we wanted to take him out, and he corrected himself.
Yeah.
You listen closely, you'll hear him.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I'll go through it one more time later on this afternoon, or maybe that's later on in the clip or something. But
about where you were.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. We'll go back to that. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate that. Good to hear from you. Scott in Richmond, Richmond, Virginia. Scott?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
The excerpt that you played of Harry Truman
reminded
me again, and I apologize if I mentioned this before on the show, the movie A Face in the Crowd with Andy Griffith.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
If you want to know what the Republicans are about, all you have to do is watch that movie. It'll change your opinion of Andy Griffith.
Oh, yeah. Here's Harry Truman. Here's the beginning of the clip. This is incredible.
Now, I want to say something very important to you about this issue of morality in government.
Morality in government?
It is just as immoral to use the lawmaking power of the government to enrich the few at the expense of the many as it is to steal money from the public treasury. That is stealing money from the public treasury.
And the Republicans?
Legislation that favored the greed of monopoly and the trickery of Wall Street was a form of corruption that did the country four times as much harm as Teapot Dome ever did.
So there you go. And and that legislation today is called the Social Security privatization.
If 50 years later, they're still saying the same things about Republicans.
Isn't it amazing? Well, that was 1952. That was 53 years ago.
It's as prescient today as it was back then.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from
you.
I appreciate it. Oh, my goodness. Are we ever going to get out from under this? Well, I think so. I really do think so. I see change. I hear change. I feel change in the wind. People are waking up. The right-wing bloviators are starting to, O'Reilly's cruise was canceled for lack of interest. The right-wing bloviators are going down. And those of us in the vast radical middle are picking up some steam here. Because, America's saying, hey, that's where we're at. We would like to have a clean environment and decent security in the United States.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, podcasting there on WhiteRoseSociety.org, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Myron Ebell is the oversees all global warming and international environment work at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He chairs the Cooler Heads Coalition, a subgroup of the National Consumers Coalition. Myron is all over the place. I saw him recently on CNN. He's been in USA Today, The Washington Post, The Anchorage Daily News, The Philadelphia Inquirer, The Manchester Union Leader, CNN, C-SPAN, National Public Radio's Living on Earth, Hardball with Chris Matthews, Debates, Voice of America, BBC, ITN, testified before six House and Senate committees. Myron Ebell, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm sorry you had to go through all that.
Well, it's quite an impressive bio, and I think it's important that our listeners realize how visible you and the Competitive Enterprise Institute are out there, because you guys are really out there beating the drum. The two attorney generals from two different states, and this was a year or so ago, as I recall, had asked John Ashcroft to investigate you guys because you had written an email in which you suggested the need to, and I quote from the email, drive a wedge between the president and those in the administration who think they are serving the president's interests by publishing this rubbish. The rubbish had having been a study that the EPA did on climate change. Why would you write that memo?
Well, because in fact the study was and is rubbish. It was done in a way that it doesn't really meet the laugh test.
And that is?
Well, it's very easy to when you're an administrator in a scientific agency like EPA, to just throw a lot of stuff together and say, see, this supports what we want to do. But in fact, of course, none of it was adequately reviewed by competent scientists. It couldn't meet standards of accuracy and predictability. We felt that the study didn't meet the Federal Data Quality Act, which sets minimal standards for scientific objectivity. So that's why I called it rubbish.
Yeah. I'm curious if you have an opinion about why it is that when you go on programs like, I saw you on Crossfire with Chris Matthews, or Hardball with Chris Matthews, and Crossfire and CNN and things like that, they don't ask you, or they don't point out that you guys receive a lot of funding from, for example, $870,000 just in the last 2 years from ExxonMobil.
Right. Well, of course, whenever I go on with anybody from an environmental group, that's the first thing they point out, and sometimes it's the only thing they point out.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we receive funding from a variety of sources, including oil companies and other energy companies.
Right. Amoco Foundation and Coca-Cola, which is not an oil company, Ford Motor
right.
Company, Koch Industries Charitable Foundation, Charles and David Koch Foundations, Pfizer, Philip Morris, Texaco Foundation, American Petroleum Institute, ARCO, Dow Chemical, General Motors. Given that you guys took in 99, the last year for which your IRS forms are published, $2.9 million from these kinds of sources, why should anybody believe your science when you have the National Academies of Science of 11 countries last week who came out and said that what you're saying is wrong?
Well,
You're saying there is no such thing as global warming, and don't worry, yeah. Be happy, and the oil yeah. companies are your friend.
Well, that's why we have public debate, so people can decide who has more credibility. The Joint National Academies of Science statement, I think, is a mixed thing. I don't think it's totally opposed to our position. For example, it makes a great deal of the fact that any policies adopted on global warming should be cost-effective. Well, the Kyoto Protocol, the global warming treaty that we signed in 1997 but the Senate has not ratified, is not cost-effective. Similarly, the McCain-Lieberman legislation currently before the Senate is not cost-effective. So I think there's some overlap there.
Well, they're not cost-effective if you're assuming that there will be no other industries taking the place of the oil industries. I mean, if you consider the possibility of an entire new industry of alternative energy and conservation being birthed as a consequence of these activities, actually, they could not only be cost-effective, they could kickstart a new boom in the economy that would make the computer boom of the 90s look like a picnic.
Well, they could, but I'm just going from a simple cost-benefit analysis
from the point of view of Exxon. Right.
No. Okay. From the point of view of economic firms, for example, the industry at the time Kyoto was negotiated in 1997, the industry coalition commissioned a bunch of works by econometric forecasting firms about what it would cost to implement the Kyoto Treaty. And one of the things that I remember very clearly was that most of the different studies came up with about the same number for the price of gasoline.
Right.
The price of gasoline will have to go up by 75 cents for us to reduce demand enough to meet the Kyoto targets.
Well, they were wrong there, because it's gone up more than that.
Well, exactly. But the people who supported Kyoto at the time said that that was exaggerating. It wouldn't cost nearly that much.
Mm.
So, you see, I think actually the costs have been understated by our side right along throughout this debate. I think the costs will be much higher.
But it costs to whom? I mean, if I'm buying something, fine. So consumers are going to have to pay more. If the consumers are paying more, that means that somebody's getting more. If somebody's getting more, that means that somebody is producing more. I mean, the equation for an economy is not A goes to B, period, and it stops. It's A goes to B, and then B figures out a way to cycle through C back to A. Then you end up, you know, if we're, and this is the position that so often is made by supply side economists, and I find, you know, it's kind of odd that I'm sort of defending this logic, but that is that. Okay, you think supply side economics is a joke?
No, I think that your theory is won't work. If you take more, this would be the same kind of idea that if people should pay more for all their goods and services, and they'll somehow be better off.
No, that wasn't the point I was making. The point I was making is that if they're paying more for something, then that means that there's more money in that particular economy, that particular mm-hmm. local part of the economy, mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. geographically local, but economically
right.
local, and that right. means that that part of the economy is going to have money to spin off new innovations, new inventions, new developments, new technologies, and that is going to, you know, this is Julian Simon 101. I mean, you know, human innovation is going to bring about change, and it's not going to happen until it's provoked by something. Now, if it's going to be provoked by a disaster, you know, it's going to be a painful change, but there will be a change. Or if it's going to be provoked by intelligent public policy, then it won't be as painful, but there'll be a change. Aren't those really the choices?
No, I actually think that raising people's costs is generally a bad thing. I think it hurts people. I think, for example, we've had a huge run-up over the last few years in the price of natural gas.
Right, but your policies have led to rising costs to people. I mean, the cost of gasoline has doubled since the last time you were on this program a year and a half ago.
Well, I don't think my policies have been followed. We've been trying to pass policies in Congress which might actually free up some energy supplies. But, I mean, the problem is, you know, in our country, in terms of higher energy prices, particularly natural gas, but also gasoline, there have been so many conflicting and contradictory environmental laws passed that it's virtually impossible to, for example, build a natural gas pipeline. Those are the kinds of policies that we're trying to change, but of course, you know, changing anything here in D.C. is rather difficult. But those are the kinds of policies we advocate, that is, more energy, not less energy. And I don't rule out renewable energy and other alternative technologies. Those are part of the answer, too. But I don't think it works to say that we can raise prices on consumers and somehow society is better off.
Isn't the bigger picture that we should not be viewing the environment as something that's entirely monetized, that, you know, we should be concerned, Myra Nobel, you should be concerned about your children and their children and their children's children, and I should be concerned about mine? I mean, isn't that where we come together as human beings?
And sure, and my family own a ranch in Oregon that isn't very economic, but it has tremendous values to us that are part of them are environmental values. I mean, we can make more money just by selling it and putting the money in the bank. So, of course, I think people do that kind of thing all the time.
Now, your your side of this argument, as it were. The Bush administration, let's say. The Bush administration has been saying, in fact, George Bush recently said in a news conference that we've not had an energy policy in the United States. And yet, we had Jimmy Carter saying, for example,
the energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
Now, this, you know, he put into place a pretty dramatic energy policy, and the first thing Ronald Reagan did when he came into office was to remove Jimmy Carter's solar panels from the roof of the White House and do away with that, and we basically haven't had an energy policy since Carter left. If we had followed Carter's energy policy, we would not be in this fix that we're in, would we?
Well, I think that Jimmy Carter's energy policy, and it was really passed by Congress, I mean, everybody went along with it, was
sure.
an absolute disaster, and in fact, it was started with the Nixon price controls. It wasn't just Jimmy Carter. And then it was all these federal bets on which technology was going to work. And what happened was that taxpayers spent a huge amount of money and got very little out of it. There's a wonderful book published by Harvard in 1990 by three people who were in different ways involved at very high levels in all of the Carter energy policy, both from the scientific and the administrative. It's called Energy Aftermath, and what they conclude is what we should have learned from the Carter energy failures was that if a technology isn't going to make it in the marketplace, no amount of federal help will put it over.
But the fact of the matter
if it is going to make it, federal help doesn't add anything.
But the fact of the matter is that federal help really did jumpstart the solar industry, and right now, if you amortize the cost of solar power over just 10-year mortgage, it's cheaper to put solar power in a house than to bring the power from the grid into it.
Well,
I mean,
Tom,
and that was because of Jimmy Carter's energy policies.
No, Tom, I actually think that solar power is about as far away from becoming a major supplier of energy as it was in the 1970s. I'd say it's still under, what, 1/100th of a percent, something like that. I mean, it's just a tiny
in terms
fraction
of consumption. But again,
yeah.
I mean, you know, you have people all across the United States who own homes because
mm-hmm.
we decided to say you can deduct from your taxes your home mortgage interest payments.
Mm-hmm.
And all Jimmy Carter was saying is if you insulate your home or you use solar power, you can deduct that. And it's just a form of encouraging an industry.
Well, look at L.A. L.A. is trying to become the solar capital of the world, and it isn't working. So
yeah.
I'd really encourage you to look at
talk to
the folks in L.A.
We've got to wrap
Thanks
it up.
Very much.
We've been talking with Myron Abell. Myron, your website is
CEI.org.
For more information on Myron Abell and his perspective, I recommend you check it out. Thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Turn the world into one big Texas.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, Mr. Bush's full-fledged, full-blown goal. Natano in Hood River, Oregon. Hey, what's up, Natano?
Well, it's great to hear the range of guests you have on your show. Hearing actual dialogue is a nice change of pace from the normal screech and preach Republican radio supporting anything Wimp Jr. does.
Yeah.
But that guy bringing it back to reality says very little return was seen on a lot of expenditures in Jimmy Carter's tax breaks.
Right.
Or energy program. That was 2% of what would go to the fossil fuels was diverted into renewable energy expenditures.
Right, and here's Jimmy Carter talking about this. Whoops, hang on just a second here.
Mm-hmm.
I got to push the right button.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Yeah, and we kind of blew that, didn't we? Natano, thanks for the call. I got to move
All
along
right.
here. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Services with us. Hey, Greg.
Hello, Tom. How you doing today?
Great. Our daily report from Washington, D.C. Usually it's Victoria or Ellen. It's nice to hear your voice.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be with you again. Victoria is actually at the White House briefing, and Ellen is in a no-cell zone.
Okay. So what's happening in the belly of the beast there?
Well, I spent the morning in the White House at the Morning Gaggle, and I have to tell you, I heard you just a little bit just now what you were talking about. The environment seems to be on everyone's mind. It was definitely on the minds of the press this morning at the White House. There's a report going around, a story that's, I believe, going to be a bigger story than it already is, about a White House official who has been changing government documents.
Yes.
And it was a big story this morning. Terry Moran of ABC News asked the question. Scott McClellan, the press secretary, he got... I think he was visibly anxious about it. He was visibly nervous.
Philip Cooney is the guy's name, and he is now the White House, the chief of staff for the White House Council on Environmental Quality, and before that he was a lobbyist at the American Petroleum Institute.
That's right.
Can you spell Fox in charge of the hen house?
Well, exactly. And, of course, this has all the smellings and all the trappings of a conspiracy, but I have to tell you, sitting in the briefing room this morning, it felt like there was more to it than what Scott obviously was leading on to the White House. So I went and did a little research. I found the story that Terry Moran was talking about. And as you just said, this gentleman is the chief of staff for this group in the White House.
Right, the White House Council on
Environmental Quality.
Right.
And he is a former lobbyist for the oil industry. Now, what happened was he has been accused or, you know, it's being spoken around town that he changed these documents to reduce the link between greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, which, of course, is a big issue because yesterday when the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom was here, he and Bush, that's one of the things they discussed.
Right.
And, of course, Blair is trying to get us, the U.S., to really look at this issue. It'll be discussed at the G8 next week in Scotland. And so this, I believe this story has legs. Something's going on. The White House, according to the White House, this man has been in this agency for years. He knows what he's talking about. Everyone that looks at these reports, apparently, the National Academy of Science says it's good science, and they have signed off on these documents. However, the press room, it was a feeding frenzy, I have to say. It was, you know, this is an oil lobbyist. Who is he? Scott promised to get the resume out to the people to let us know who he is, who he was, and why he changed these documents. Of course, the White House flatly denied the characterization that he's a former lobbyist who has changed documents based on anything other than science.
Andrew Revkin in the New York Times today said Cooney's alterations are sometimes as simple as the insertion of an adjective, but they cause shifts in the meaning of documents. And then he adds he's a lawyer with a bachelor's degree in economics but has no scientific training.
Well, that's what I was about to say. He has no scientific training. The story was in the New York Times now today, so it'll be more widely looked at. And that's exactly what came up this morning. He'll put in a word, maybe, the word significant before a word. He'll put in the word uncertainty and change the meaning.
Right.
It's very subtle, but it's definitely a story. So we'll see what happens.
Amazing, amazing. Okay, Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Greg, for the report today from Washington, D.C.
Absolutely.
Great to hear from you. Ah, my, what tangled webs the Bush administration weaves when they practice to deceive year after year after year. And now finally the American people are waking up. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone, 1-866-889-8894. The website, tomhartman.com. If you'd like to drop in, click live chat. It'll drop you into the chat room where you can hang out with some of the finest minds on the whole entire Internet. Oh, my goodness. What is going on? It sure looks to me like Tony Blair came over here with some specific things on his mind. He's you know, George, I've helped you out here. That's not a Blair imitation by any means. But anyhow, he's coming over saying that he's helped out George Bush. He's helped him out with the war. He's been there. He's had British soldiers die over this. He nearly lost an election because of this. He lost a good chunk of the majority that he had in Parliament over his support of George Bush. He's laughed at, ridiculed by the British people for being the Blair's poodle. He's referred to as Toady Blair rather than Tony Blair. And he comes over here and he says to Bush, you know, I've done all this for you. Don't you have any gratitude? Can't you help me out here? And Bush says, nope. One of the things that I thought was really interesting watching the press conference yesterday was how Blair was literally talking out of one side of his mouth. I have never seen Tony Blair do this before. Now, again, I'm not British. I don't watch him on the press every day, but I certainly have seen a number of times where he's, you know, on C-SPAN, where he's doing prime ministers, whatever they call it, the questioning every week, where he sits down with or stands up with members of Parliament and has to answer their questions, prime minister's questions, I think is what it's called. And Blair is usually literally talking out of both sides of his mouth. I mean, I'm talking about physically looking at somebody's face. You know, there's this old thing about, you know, one side, one hemisphere of the brain controls the intellect, and the other side of the brain, the other hemisphere of the brain controls emotion. And it's wildly oversimplified, but there is some truth to it. We know, for example, that the difference between Broca's region and Wernicke's region, the two parts of the temporal lobes of the brain, the part of the brain just above the ears or right around the ears. On one side, Broca's region, it controls speech. It's verbal. On the other side, Wernicke's region, it's nonverbal. It doesn't have the ability to understand speech. It controls music. You know, it handles sound, and it handles instinctive reactions to sound, startle things and things like that. And so, there really are these two sides of the brain. And when you see people who are talking with one half of their mouth, and the other half of their mouth doesn't move much. Dick Cheney does this all the time. It usually means one of two things. Either they've suffered a stroke at some point in their life, and part of their brain has shut down, or they've had a nerve, you know, a myofascial injury in the nerves on their face, so they're not actually able to move half their mouth. Either that is, it's physiological, or they are saying something that they absolutely do not believe to be true. And the part of them that doesn't believe it's true is trying not to move their mouth. And the part of them that thinks that they have to say it is moving their mouth. And go back and look at the video clips. They're probably on C-SPAN. Go back and look at the video clips of Tony Blair yesterday, particularly when he was answering the question about the Downing Street memo. And the right side of his mouth was not moving. And he was talking out of the left side of his mouth. And I'm watching that going, this is fascinating. Now, I see Bush do this a fair amount, although not always. As I said, Dick Cheney, it's almost the norm. And it may be that he had a stroke during one of his heart surgeries. I don't know. I don't want to read more into this than just the observation. But I just found it fascinating. And there's a reason why we have this phrase in the English language. You know, cliches are usually cliches because there's some truth to them. There is a reason why we have this phrase. Oh, he's talking out of one side of his mouth. Because, you know, we know that when people talk out of one side of their mouth, it usually means that they're lying. Or they're doing something that's really inconsistent. So Tony Blair comes over and he says, George, there's just two things I need some help with here. I need some help trying to raise money for Africa. Now, this is a particular problem for the UK and for the other former colonial powers of Europe. I mean, we were here in America, we were buying slaves, we were bringing slaves from Africa, but we weren't colonizing Africa. The UK did. I was in Uganda during the war in 1980 with Idi Amin, and it was nothing more or less than the result of the UK going in, colonizing this area, and then dividing areas up without any respect for ethnic or tribal regions. You know, just however you do, they would create countries and divide nations based on what company or what baron or whatever, you know, what royal force wanted what resources. And okay, you can have that jungle, and you can have the coconuts, and you can have the oil, you know, and you can have the coca plantation, and you can have the tea, and you can, you know, it's like that. And this is how, you know, much of Africa got divided up, and it was a prescription for disaster. And then when they started getting criticized in the 1950s, as I recall, about, you know, their colonial footprint, about still controlling Africa, the British said, okay, that's it. We're walking. We're leaving. We're out of here. And they just walked away. And you can't just do that without causing chaos. And so, you know, the British and the Belgians and the French in particular, you know, King Leopold's Ghost, amazing book. The British, the French, the Belgians in particular, they have a legacy of colonialism in Africa that haunts them. And Tony Blair rightly has significant concerns about this. You know, his nation, his people, his nation played a significant role in creating the chaos that is happening in Africa right now. And, you know, I think most Americans are not sensitive to that. Most Americans don't think in those terms. They don't realize that because the United States was never really a colonial power in Africa, or at least in sub-Saharan Africa. Arguably, we were in North Africa to the extent that we interfered in the politics of Egypt. And, you know, and early on, you know, around World War II, and you could argue Libya, but particularly Egypt and the Middle East as you make that transition there. But nonetheless, it's really, you know, America doesn't have this concern or complex about Africa the way the British do. So Tony Blair comes over and he says, you know, and although I think that, frankly, we should, you know, have the concern of, hey, they're human beings, we're human beings. Human beings are in trouble. Let's do something about it. I mean, we've got to liberate the people of Iraq, right? Got to liberate the people. Well, they're sitting on a lot of oil. But 2 million people, 3 million people on the verge of starvation in Zimbabwe, not a big deal. A couple hundred thousand people already murdered, as many as 2 million facing starvation and murder. Rape as a normal way of doing business for the Sudanese government. In the Darfur region, this ethnic cleansing, the Bush administration, So, anyhow, Tony Blair comes over and he says, you know, as human beings, we have an obligation to Africa. Bush says, no. He unveils a plan to spend $674 million in emergency aid in Africa. This is money that Congress had already approved. But the Washington Post, suckers, Washington Post bought it, hook, line, and sinker. The Washington Post runs a headline, Bush, Blair agree on aid for African famine relief. Yeah, right. I don't think so. Something going on in there I need to know about? Okay. So then Tony Blair comes over and he says, you know, global warming. We got a problem here with global warming. There's you know, and the 11 nations now, the National Academy of Sciences of 11 nations just produced a document saying global warming is real and it's caused by human beings. We don't care what the folks from the Competitive Enterprise Institute have to say about it. It's real. And it's right now. It is right now causing the destruction of ecosystems all around the world. The parts of South America that are glaciated, the glaciers are evaporating, drying up. They're not being replenished. And downriver, you've got communities that are areas that are becoming desert that were once forest and jungle. Farmlands are blowing away. The same thing happening in Central Asia. This is the same thing happening in central China. There's a big article in the New York Times a couple days ago about how the glaciers in central China are vanishing, and it's freaking everybody out. They're discovering that the floods that they're having downriver from the glaciers in the Himalayas, that the floods are not the result entirely of the monsoon rains being more violent than in the past. It's playing a small role in it, but it's that. And they've just been able to measure this over the last couple of years. They just finally figured out a way to measure this. It's because the glaciers are melting so rapidly, they're dumping more water into the rivers. They're the normal source of the rivers. Right? And then the rains, the monsoon rains come, and that just adds to the problem. But the monsoon rains are not replenishing the glaciers. They're not making it all the way up there to turn into snow to fall on the glaciers. The weather patterns around the world are changing. And this is today, right now, causing problems, causing the deaths of millions. I mean, literally, causing the deaths of millions, creating famines in areas that used to produce food, destroying croplands in areas that didn't used to be underwater and now are, creating desert in areas that were lush. I mean, things are changing. And are we going to ignore reality, or are we going to take it on? Tony Blair has said he has vowed to make climate change a central issue at the G8 meeting. This G8 meeting is coming up. And he's trying to get Bush on board. Because without the United States, ain't nothing going to happen. We are spectacularly successful at blocking initiatives, whether it be to end the international proliferation of nuclear weapons, or whether it be to deal with climate change, or whether it be to deal with, you know, pollution. I mean, pick a topic. We have been spectacularly successful at preventing success. So Bush comes over here and he says to Blair, Blair comes over here and he says to Bush, please help me out here. Please help me out. Just two little things. All you got to do is toss $1 billion at Africa. It's the amount of money you spend in a couple of days in Iraq. I mean, we're spending $100 billion a year in Iraq. What is that? Every 3.5 days, $1 billion. 3.5 days worth of Iraq. Toss that to us. Bush says no. Blair says, this thing with climate change, I mean, this is a real problem. You got to help us out here. Bush says, no, I've been reading the reports. They've been coming to me from my man, Philip Cooney. And they all say that there's no problem. Philip Cooney, the White House chief of staff, the chief of staff of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, the lawyer who has been doctoring scientific documents. We got nothing to worry about. Mr. Cooney tells me all is well. And Tony Blair goes home empty-handed. And then to add insult to injury, he finds that he has to lie to help George W. Bush. Now, because now it's reached the point where he's having to lie to save his own skin. I mean, if at this point Tony Blair was to start admitting that he had been part of a fraud and a deception that had led to the death of British citizens, and it did, he'd be toast. I mean, there are those people who say, well, why doesn't he throw George Bush over the edge? In fact, I said it in the last hour. Why doesn't he throw Bush over the edge? But the reality is that if he were to do that, he'd be throwing himself over the edge, too. Because he's so far into it now, because Brits have died. There is just no way that he can do anything except hope it goes away. This is a absolute disaster. And now we have the administration, the Family Values Administration. The number of active duty soldiers getting divorced has been rising sharply with deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq, reports USA Today today, an article by Greg Zoya. Trend is heaviest among officers, up 78% from 2003, the year before the Iraq invasion, and more than three and a half times the number in 2000 before the Afghan operation. You're talking a 350% increase in divorce among officers' families in the U.S. military. A 350% increase in the divorce rate. Stress of combat, long separations, and difficulty readjusting to family life are key reasons for the surge, Army officials say, reports USA Today. Should it surprise anybody? I suppose not. It's just amazing to me. None of these guys, the only person in the administration who seemed to be opposed to this war from the get-go was Colin Powell. He's the only one who's seen people die in battle. All the rest of them are chicken hawks. Or, you know, in the case of Don Rumsfeld, didn't serve during time of war. Dick Cheney, he had other priorities during the Vietnam War. George Bush. He gets into the champagne unit of the Texas Air National Guard by having his daddy pull strings for him, and then he goes AWOL for 9 months. And you go on down the line. Wolfowitz, Feith, Pearl, all these guys, Condi, well, I mean, you know, she could have volunteered. None of them saw fit to participate in our military. And so, you know, all they've seen are the movies. And they haven't seen, I don't think they've seen the Deer Hunter kind of movies. They've seen the old John Wayne movies. And they just think it's just the noble thing. You get out there and you have a war and the president, everybody gets behind the president and everything goes so cool and war is just such a great thing. And that's George Bush's idea of it. And even now he's being insulated from reality. He doesn't attend funerals. He won't allow photos of coffins coming back. Even now. Time for us to get politically active, my friends, and bring about a change in this country. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
He's a cowboy president. But he wears a black hat in America. Can't get away with that.
Well, and he's not quite a cowboy either because he's afraid of horses. So he drives a pickup truck instead. He's a pickup truck president. There you go. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Jim in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Good show again. I appreciate listening to you. I have to point out one thing, though, when you made that quick comment about Bush and military funerals. No president has ever attended military funerals. Going all the way back to Washington, Lincoln attended one, but that was for a personal friend that was killed very early in the war. Wilson didn't, FDR didn't, Harry Truman didn't. None of them did.
Did not Bill Clinton attend the funerals of the people who died in Serbia and Bosnia?
I don't believe so. No.
I've seen a photo of him in front of caskets. Did he just attend their coming back at Andrews Air Force Base?
That could be because the choice has always come down to how do you single people out.
Yeah, and that's a difficult one.
And that's why presidents just stay above the whole thing.
Yeah, and you're right. That's a good point. And so.
I have no higher regard for George Bush than you do, but I do have to point that out. Presidents don't attend funerals of servicemen killed in action.
Yeah, you're right. It's a good point. So why then is George saying that that's the toughest part of his job? Comforting families.
W doesn't always tell the truth.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, this is that's the toughest part of my job here. It's remarkable.
The hardest things I do as the president is to try to comfort families who've lost a loved one.
So there you go. I mean, what's he talking about?
He just likes people to think it's a tough thing for him to do.
Yeah, I guess so. Jim, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Yeah.
You know, the hardest things I do as the president is to try to comfort families who've lost a loved one.
I don't think so. Somehow I don't think so. And speaking of backbones, how's that for a transition? Abetting the conservative agenda, said Hillary Rodham Clinton yesterday. This was in the New York Times. Is the Washington Press Corps who has become a pale imitation of the Watergate era reporter. She's talking about, you know, what happened to Watergate? Where did the folks go? She says the press is missing in action with all due respect. And she's talking to the press when she says this. Where are the investigative reporters today? Why aren't they asking the hard questions? It's shocking when you see how easily they fold in the media today. They don't stand their ground. If they're criticized by the White House, they just fall apart. I mean, come on, toughen up, guys. It's only our Constitution and country at stake. Let's get some spine. End of quote from Hillary Clinton. Well, good on you, Hillary Rodham Clinton. I salute you for that. Congratulations. Maybe she will make a good president. I think that there's a good chance she'll be our next president, whether you like it or not. And as I've said many times, I'm still making up my mind. We'll see. Anyhow, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, where smart people get their news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Alec Dubrow is with us. Alec is with the International Labor Communications Association. They give us an update on what's going on in the world of organized labor, or as Tom from Minneapolis and I like to call it, democracy in the workplace. Hey, Alec.
That's a great phrase, Tom. Hi, how are you?
Great. What's happening in labor today?
Well, a lot, but I wanted to call attention to an interesting phenomenon that's going on right now. I've gotten a lot of reports crossing my desk about a tour going on in the United States of Iraqi labor leaders who are touring the U.S. to speak with the labor movement about meeting other trade unionists about conditions faced by Iraqi workers.
I thought, though, that the Constitution that Paul Bremer wrote for Iraq outlawed labor unions, it outlaws labor unions in the private sector, didn't it?
Only in the private sector. Actually, it technically says that labor is perfectly legal. However, it left in place a 1987 law that Saddam Hussein passed, outlawing it in the public sector or anything connected with the public sector, which at this point involves approximately 70% of Iraqi workers.
Right.
So the truth of the matter is the U.S. basically outlawed organized labor, or at least
a good chunk of it.
And what's so fascinating to me is that we're being called on to support trade unionists because the United States went there to bring them freedom and prosperity, and at the moment they have neither one. What we're hearing from them is that unemployment is at 50% nationwide and 70% in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's bad enough, but the coalition authority lowered the base industrial wages of Iraqi workers from $60 to $40 a month, and they set at an absolute all public sector workers' wages at $35 a month. And it gets even more bizarre because they abolished, well, not technically the U.S., but the monthly food ration, which was sustaining a large proportion of the population, was abolished by the debtor nations because it violated free market principles. So they're in a lot of trouble there, and they need our help. So,
how, you know, what can we do? I mean, I don't think that most Americans even realize that the Bush administration outlawed labor unions to a large extent in Iraq. Most Americans don't realize the extent to which our rewriting their constitution was basically a rape of their country. I tell you, the Iraqis certainly realize it, and they are really angry about it.
They certainly are angry about it, and one of the apparent goals of the Bush administration was privatization. In fact, it may have been the most basic goal, or at least the most basic ideological goal that they're going after. In 2003, the Coalition Provisional Authority issued Order Number 39 permitting 100% foreign ownership of almost all Iraqi businesses and giving big tax breaks and imposing only a small flat tax on the new owners.
Right, 15%. And also allowing for 100% repatriation of profits. So a foreign company can operate a business in Iraq and take all of the profit out of the country. They can basically strip mine the country. And any attempt by the Iraqis or the Iraqi government or even local governments to say, hey, wait a minute, if you're going to do business here, you have to produce some benefit for us. No, sorry.
Yeah, that's right. And it was interesting. No, we don't know about it, but the General Secretary of the International Confederation of Arab Trade Unions said, and this wasn't anti-American per se, he said, war makes privatization easy. First you destroy the society, then you let the corporations rebuild it. Well, rebuild is a funny word, but in this case, because it's certainly not being rebuilt to the benefit of most people, but it is being rebuilt for profit, where they can provide the necessary security, which again is kind of dodgy. So It's tough. Iraqi businesses are being hawked all over the world, especially in Washington and London, and then we wonder why the Brits got into the war. We've destroyed the wealth of the country, making it so that huge numbers of middle-class people have fled, taking their money with them. So who can buy what remains of the businesses? Not the Iraqis who've decided to stay and tough it out. And that, you know, the lowering of wages and the inability of the workers to organize or to protect themselves against this rampant privatization puts them in, a bad position. I heard an Iraqi on TV a couple of weeks ago saying, we have a saying here, it can't get any worse. And then the next day we have to say it again. Gets worse and worse.
So these labor leaders from Iraq are traveling around the United States,
right,
and they're asking for help. Are they just talking to Iraqi, or are they just talking to American labor groups, or are they going beyond that? Are they getting, what kind of reception are they getting from the media, for example? Anybody paying attention to them?
Not that I've heard. The tour hasn't actually started yet. It's starting on Friday.
I see.
And they're going in groups of two, but on the East Coast, Midwest, and West Coast.
Right.
And they're primarily being shepherded by labor and speaking to labor. But I got a flyer from one of the interns here showing a meeting being held at George Washington University. So
right.
My assumption is that they will branch out and talk to students, to anybody who cares to go. Anybody who wants to know about this should go to the website uslaboragainstwar.org, all one word.
uslaboragainstwar.org. Okay.
Right. It's a labor group, obviously, opposed to the war. And you'll get some interesting stuff.
I wanted to ask you about that, Alec. I was with IE America Radio Network a year or so ago when they were still in business, which was owned by the United Auto Workers. And and there was a lot of dispute about the war at that time. And, you know, UAW never told us what to say or not say on the air or anything like that. But mm-hmm. one of the things that I got from my conversations with folks who worked at the network was that not necessarily that particular union, but the labor in general, and perhaps that union, I frankly don't remember, was very conflicted about taking a position on the war. Has that changed?
Not really, and that is a difficulty because people are torn between a critical view, perhaps, of this and intense feelings of patriotism, and it's difficult for individuals to take a stand. It's certainly difficult for labor.
Right.
Were groups of there were specific unions which had taken a stand against the war, generally the public sector unions, but the industrial unions had either taken no stand or given a general "we support our troops" kind of thing.
Yeah, and we've got the larger problem, I suppose, of so many people in America believing that Saddam Hussein and Iraq were somehow behind 9/11, and that what we're doing in Iraq is payback for 9/11, or that Saddam Hussein and Iraq were somehow responsible for terrorism around the world, and that this is, you know, preventing that, when in fact there had never been a terrorist incident in Iraq. There were no Iraqis involved with 9/11. Saddam Hussein hated Osama bin Laden. In fact, Osama bin Laden tried to organize a private army on the border between Saudi Arabia and Iraq to invade Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein because he was secular, and Osama wanted to replace him with a religious Arab, a religious Sunni, a Muslim bunch.
Mm-hmm.
But most Americans are completely unaware of that, and so they think that, well, maybe the war is going bad, but at least there was a justification for it, a reason for it. Half of Americans still think that these connections are there because, you know, the Hannitys and the Limbaughs of the world and the Fox Newses of the world and certainly the Bush administration and Frank Luntz's and these bunch have worked so hard to conflate these two, to try to cause people to, you know, like Bush, when he gives his speech, he'll talk about 9/11, and then he'll talk about Iraq, and then he'll talk about 9/11, and he'll talk about Iraq, and he never comes out and says Iraq had anything to do with 9/11, but you hear the speech and it just gets beaten in and beaten in and beaten in until, you know, you reach the point where, you know, 70% of Americans at the time of the last election and 50% now believe that Saddam Hussein personally had something to do with 9/11 and that Iraqis were in the airplanes that flew into the World Trade Center.
Well, it's fascinating. Yes.
And that's got to be a lot of union members.
Certainly. I mean, they represent a cross-section of Americans that they will have those kind of views in the same proportion as others. These are articles of faith to people, you know, and it's very difficult to chip away at them. I remember I was on a union campaign in Wichita, Kansas, and I was reading their letters section in the newspaper, and there was one that said boldly, "I don't care what anyone says, there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq." So, I mean, if that's the kind of stand people are taking, it, you know, how do you undercut it? I don't care what anyone says.
Right.
There it is, you
right.
know.
Don't confuse me with the facts.
Right. I believe it because I want to believe it, because it feels good, and it justifies a particular action. But, you know, it's... Bush's support, or at least support for the war in general, continues to slip. Whether it'll slip to the point where any changes in policy will take place, I don't know. But, you know, the fact that people conflate Saddam Hussein or Iraq with 9/11 makes it very difficult for things. Because, for instance, here the trade union people are coming here to build union-to-union solidarity and, quote, support for Iraqi trade unionists in their effort to build a progressive, secular Iraq. This is exactly the kind of thing that al-Qaeda hates and continues to hate. The trade unions themselves are targeted by religious insurgents. They are, you know, they are the people who are, in fact, exemplifying what we say we want to do there.
And we should keep in mind, and we need to remind people over and over again, that secular does not mean non-religious. It means civil government. It means institutions that are, you know, we the people deciding, you know, what kind of fire department we want. We have secular fire departments. Secular simply means civil government. It doesn't mean anti-religion. As much as the Bill O'Reillys of the world want people to think that secular means anti-religion, it doesn't. It means civil government.
Exactly.
And so you've got secular labor unions. They're not opposed to religion. They're just labor unions.
They're labor unions in which religion does not play a determining role.
Right.
And it's much more important in a country like Iraq, which has strong religious antagonisms, that a civil institution not have religious means tests in it.
Right.
In other words, you know, anyone can join our labor union if they're a worker, not if they're a Sunni or a Shiite or a Kurd, whatever it happens to be.
Right. But the religious folks don't like that much in Iraq, just like they don't like it here.
I think you're onto something.
Yeah, the Ayatollahs among us would rather that you know, from the Pat Roberts and the Jerry Falwell Ayatollahs to the Ayatollahs and the Sunnis and the Shia over there. It's they just don't like the whole thing. Well, it's fascinating. ILCAOnline.org.
That's
international.
Us.
Yep, the International Labor Communications Association. Alec Dubrow, the media coordinator, been with us here. And you want to give us one more time, real quickly, that website for the.
Yes, www.uslaboragainstwar.org. See the Iraqis when they're in your town.
There you go, uslaboragainstwar.org. Thanks a lot, Alec.
Okay, thank you, Bob.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. TomHartman.com, the website. If you want to drop into our live chat room, simply click live chat. If you want to participate in the blog and message board, you can click that link. Or read articles about democracy or any many other things that are there on the website. Lots of cool stuff, lots of fun things. Frank in Phoenix on the line. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I wanted to talk to you about the funerals and presidents and so on and so forth.
Okay.
I'll try to be real quick. Franklin Roosevelt, what he did was do a radio address after the attack on Pearl Harbor. But there's this one Democrat, and as far as I can tell, he's the only one that actually did attend funerals, and that was Lyndon Johnson. He attended two actual funerals.
Oh, interesting.
He did one for Captain Albert Smith and Major General Keith R. Ware, who died in
Vietnam.
Why did he attend those funerals?
The first one was Smith, was son of the White House correspondent Merriman Smith.
Oh, okay. So it was somebody he knew.
Yeah, and he actually met Major General Ware while visiting Vietnam.
Okay, so he was he had a personal reason to attend these two funerals.
Uh-huh. Richard Nixon, let's see, he met with the family of Colonel Nolde, N-O-L-D-E.
Uh-huh.
He met with that family. Jimmy Carter, what he did was attend the memorial service for the soldiers that were killed in the failed rescue of the American hostages in Iran.
Right.
Reagan, he attended the memorial service for the occasion of the American soldiers at Camp Lejeune.
Mm-hmm.
President H.W. Bush, he didn't appear at anything, it doesn't look like. But Bill Clinton, he attended the services in October 2000 in memory of the 17 sailors that died in the attack on the USS Cole.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that must be the one that I saw him at the... I saw a photo of him with a whole bunch of caskets, and you know, I assumed it was a funeral, a memorial service or something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and so. He also, the terrorist bombing with the Mira building in Oklahoma City.
He attended the memorial for that as well.
That's what it looks like. That's what I'm taking.
All right.
At least he publicly grieved for them. I'm not sure if he actually attended. It doesn't say.
Frank, any info on who the lucky family is that got comforted by George W. Bush Jr.?
There's nothing, absolutely nothing about that guy on the website that I'm looking at.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
So the mystery family. Or families.
Let me see. Attended a funeral. I have no idea. Let me see another chart.
That's okay, Frank.
I just wanted to let you know about that.
Okay, I appreciate it.
You have a good one. Yep.
Thanks, you too. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you, Frank. Oh, my goodness, my goodness, my goodness. Well, we have a little bit of news here.
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
Yes, Tom DeLay has hired a second lawyer for a possible ethics inquiry. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay has beefed up his legal defense team as the House Ethics Committee moved to resolve a lingering dispute, reports the Houston Chronicle, that has stalled an investigation into his overseas travel. Advisors to DeLay confirmed Monday that he has hired a second attorney, Richard Cullen, former state attorney general in Virginia, with extensive experience in criminal law and politics, to represent the lawmaker in potential House investigations. And one of the things that is causing the problem here is that when DeLay got rid of members of the House Ethics Committee who were actually interested in investigating ethics, I'm talking about Republicans that he got rid of, he replaced the chairman with Doc Hastings, Republican from Washington, who had received money from DeLay's his PAC. And so you got Doc, and now Doc Hastings is trying to put his longtime chief of staff, Ed Cassidy, in to oversee the committee operations, put him in charge of this thing. And the committee's not excited about it. DeLay wants it to happen, and things are not doing well. In fact, the Republicans, they say, are attempting to do an end run around the ethics rules. Yep. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a beautiful day.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The It's No Surprise Department, but gee, I wish it wasn't so. Bloomberg reports, Bloomberg News Service, owned by the mayor of New York City now, the multimillionaire Michael Bloomberg. Bloomberg reports that the Interior Department Inspector General, this from the American Progress Action Fund, that the Interior Department Inspector General concluded that the Bush administration offered in 2002 to overpay a prominent Florida family for oil and gas rights on every laid lands. Now, it gets a little more complicated than just this. So you start out the Bush administration going to a family, a very wealthy family, I might add, in Florida, a millionaire family in Florida, and offering to take your and my tax dollars and hugely overpay them. President Bush announced in May of 2002 that the government would spend $120 million plus additional tax deductions to prevent Collier Resources Company from drilling for oil and gas in the Everglades. Okay, so we're going to buy up their right to drill so that they don't drill and create a political embarrassment for Jeb Bush. Now, here's where it gets weird, or even weirder. We're giving them $120 million, plus we're giving them tax deductions for rights that have been valued at between $5 and $68 million. And the announcement generated suspicions when just 2 weeks later, Florida Governor Jeb Bush said he would run for re-election. And members of the Collier family, surprise, surprise, contributed more than $121,000 to Republican candidates in the last election cycle, including a substantial donation to Jeb Bush. Yes, indeed. Enough to make you crazy. Well, speaking of making you crazy, Andy Borowitz has his take on John Bolton. Bolton's anger tied to gamma ray accident. Don't make me angry, UN nominee tells reporters. John R. Bolton, President Bush's choice to be the next ambassador to the United Nations, offered rare insight into his much-storied anger today, telling reporters that his uncontrollable rage stemmed from a freak gamma ray accident that occurred during his early career as a research scientist. Bolton told reporters in Washington, "Before I got into government, I was a scientist working in the field of gamma ray research. It was during one day of work in my laboratory that an experiment went awry and I was belted by gamma rays." When pressed by a reporter as to how exposure to gamma rays could have caused his legendary anger, Mr. Bolton appeared to fume and warned the reporter, "Don't make me angry. You won't like me when I'm angry." But moments later, after the reporter doggedly repeated his question, a vein in Mr. Bolton's head appeared to throb, his skin turned an otherworldly shade of green, and he began bursting out of his clothes, his muscles growing to monstrous proportions. No longer speaking intelligible English, Mr. Bolton roared, picked up the reporter, and heaved him through a plate glass window. The UN nominee then ran out into the briefing room and into the parking lot where he began hurling cars to and fro. When asked about Mr. Bolton's shocking rampage, President Bush said, "I still think he's the best man to fix the United Nations." Thanks to Andy Borowitz, theborowitzreport.com. Back to I want to get back to Florida for just a minute. We were just talking about the corruption of the Bush family and Jeb Bush and his brother George Jr., you know, helping him out with the 2002 election by taking $120 million of your money and mine and using it to buy out the oil and gas rights in the Everglades that were held by a wealthy Republican family, turning a huge profit for them, a substantial profit for them. Now we have Catherine Harris has announced that she's going to run for the United States Senate. Catherine Harris. Now, you know and I know, you know, assuming that you're one of the folks in America who's been paying attention, unlike the media, that you know and I know that Catherine Harris's crime, and in my opinion, it was a crime worthy of criminal prosecution. Catherine Harris's crime was illegally purging the voting rolls in the state of Florida of between 50 and 90,000 predominantly African-American, predominantly Democratic registered voters. Thus, you know, leveling the playing field between Al Gore and George W. Bush for the 2000 election campaign. That Al Gore would have easily won the state of Florida by at least 10, 20, 30,000 votes if Catherine Harris hadn't thrown off the voting rolls people who legally and legitimately were registered to vote and should have voted. They showed up and they were not allowed to vote. I mean, the NAACP still has a lawsuit about this, you know, moving through the courts slowly. now that the Bush administration, now that George Bush has appointed fully 25% of all federal judges in the last 4.5 years, a quarter of all federal judges are Bush appointees. I mean, that's enough to give you chills, right? So, anyhow, the newspaper, I don't have a press account on this. This is just Dateline Tallahassee, Florida. It was in the Oregonian today. It's in newspapers all over the country. I'm assuming it's an AP story, but I'm not sure. It might be UPI, which is owned by Reverend Moon, but because it doesn't say. But the headline, controversy Republican eyes U.S. Senate seat. And one of the things that it doesn't point out is that Catherine Harris was thinking of running in 2004, and the Republicans asked her not to run for the United States Senate in 2004 because they were concerned that if she was on the ballot in Florida, it would so anger the Democrats that they would show up in larger numbers and cause Bush to lose the state to John Kerry. Okay, so I'm sure she said, come on, we own the voting machines. What are you talking about? But she did stay out of the race, so now she's decided that she's going to jump in. And here, the press report says, get this. Now, you and I know that her crime is removing, you know, just short of 100,000 Democratic African-American voters from the voting rolls. That's her crime. That's how they fixed the Florida election in 2000. And even at that, when it came in so close that it was difficult to count, then they had to go to the Supreme Court and stop the count, right? But the paper says she's also despised by some Democrats for her role in overseeing the recount that ultimately gave Florida and the White House to George W. Bush over Al Gore. What has happened to the media in America? Why this is in the local news, this is in the national newspaper. She's despised by Democrats for her role in the recount. Nobody's despising her for her role in the recount. She had nothing to do with the recount. I mean, she was Secretary of State. I suppose you could say she oversaw it. But the fact of the matter is, it was the Republican Party that sued Al. It was George Bush personally, actually, who hired a trial lawyer and sued Al Gore before the Supreme Court to stop the recount. It wasn't about the recount. It was about Catherine Harris stealing the vote by illegally throwing voters off the rolls. Something that was reported by the BBC. Not reported in America for a while, but reported by the BBC. And I still think to this day most Americans don't know this. In the Wall Street Journal today, I'd like to just shift to economics for a moment here, if I can make that segue in your brain for a second. The Chinese central bank chief. Now, this may sound dry and didactic. It's not. I'm telling you, this is going to hit us. You know, these are pocketbook issues. This is where it gets down to. The Chinese central bank chief Zhao Xiaochan warned that mounting political pressure on Beijing to revalue its currency and overblown expectations about how such a move might help correct imbalances in the world economy are making it more difficult for China to take action. Now, this was at a meeting, a gathering of world bankers in Beijing yesterday. At the same meeting, Alan Greenspan, coming in by satellite link, you know, TV appearance, said he is confident Beijing will make the move reasonably soon. Now, here's what's going on. For 200 years in America, the way that we equalized trade was with tariffs. It was very simple and very straightforward. We said, you know, if somebody is going to, and I always use shoes as the example, everybody understands shoes. And we don't make shoes in America anymore, so I think everybody really understands it. If there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made in New Jersey, and there's a dollar's worth of labor in that pair of shoes, and that manufacturer wants to make that same pair of shoes in Malaysia, or in, say, Saipan, where Tom DeLay went over and intervened so that they wouldn't have the U.S. minimum wage. And so in Saipan, they're going to make that same pair of shoes. Textiles is their major industry. They're going to make that same pair of shoes, and shoes are, you know, not textiles, but arguably close. In any case, they're going to make the same pair of shoes there, and it only costs 10 cents for the labor to sew those shoes together. then what we said was, that's fine, you can make your shoes anywhere you want. We're not going to tell you where to make your shoes. What we are going to tell you, however, is that when you bring those shoes into the United States, you have to pay us a 90-cent tax. So that the cost to you to make the shoes in Saipan is the same as the cost to make the shoes in the United States. Now, this the tax is called an import tariff. And that tariff did two things. It served two purposes. And we've had tariffs in the United States from 1787 up until Ronald Reagan. Actually, we still have tariffs. It's just that most of them have become, you know, minimal. They've become irrelevant. They've become marginal. But, you know, and there's hundreds of categories of goods. I mean, we went through very, very, very carefully. What industries in the United States are important to us? Is it important to us that we have a steel industry in the United States? Might we someday have to build tanks to fight a war or airplanes? Is it important to us in the United States to have a steel industry? Is it important to us in the United States to have a computer industry? Is it important to us in the United States to manufacture telephones? Is it important to us in the United States to manufacture fabrics? Did you know that increasingly we're having to go to China to get the fabric to make uniforms for our soldiers? Now, historically, the answer to those questions had always been yes. It's important to have these domestic industries, not just for to have the jobs here, but also for security purposes. So anyhow, there were two positive benefits to tariffs. The first was that it kept jobs here in the United States, kept Americans employed, and it defined and maintained our standard of living. We didn't have to bring the rest of the world up to our standard of living. We didn't suddenly find ourselves in the position of saying, well, gee, if American workers are making $15 an hour and in Saipan they're making $3 an hour, maybe American workers should make $8 an hour and people in Saipan should make $8 an hour. We didn't do the great leveling thing. We just said, hey, you know, our policies in this country are designed to protect this country. And if we're going to help out Saipan, we'll figure out a rational way to help out Saipan. But stripping out the middle class in America is not the way to do it. There are other ways to do it. This is not about international welfare policies or international relief policies or international development policies. So the first benefit of tariffs was that it kept jobs at home, which also, as I pointed out, helped our security situation. The second benefit of tariffs was that it actually generated revenue for the government. Because there will always be some people who are going to say, well, you know, okay, it costs a buck to make the shoes here, it costs a buck to make the shoes in Taiwan, but I'm going to make them in Taiwan anyway. Or as market conditions change, maybe, you know, it's going to cost me 95 cents to make them in Taiwan, so I'll make them in Taiwan, even though I'm paying a 90-cent tariff, because the labor cost there just went from 10 cents down to 5 cents. And so we had these tariffs, and these tariffs were the source. In fact, they were the source of funding for the federal government from the founding of this country up until the Civil War. Virtually all of our government functions were paid for by import tariffs. And then Reagan comes along and he says, oh no, the multinational corporations don't like that. GE doesn't like that. General Motors doesn't like that. They would like to be able to buy their... Nike doesn't like that. Phil Knight would like to be able to buy his products, his shoes, from Southeast Asia, where it costs less to make them. That way he can make more profit. So you won't have workers making money here in the United States, but Phil Knight will become a billionaire. So it's still, you know, money here in the United States. It's just money for rich people instead of for workers. That's the Republican way. And so Reagan started dismantling this, started pushing for fast-track trade policy, that he could negotiate trade deals to eliminate tariffs. He didn't get it. George Bush Sr. got it. And then Clinton fought for it and got it. And then Clinton passed, you know, WTO and NAFTA, which in my opinion is an absolute disaster. And basically what we've done is we've done away with these tariffs. So the government now is in a position of how do we stop this cheap junk from coming into the United States if we're not going to use tariffs? Well, the way that the geniuses in the Bush administration have come up with is to say, let's talk the Chinese into revaluing their currency so that, you know, right now it's 8 won to the dollar, basically, 8.28, so that if $1, instead of buying 8 won, $1 will only buy 5 won. So everything in China is going to go up in price 30% when it comes into the United States. Now, the benefit of that is to China. Right? I mean, all of a sudden, we're paying 30% more. They're making 30% more profit. It will import fewer goods, but the government doesn't make anything from the tariffs. And it's not selective. We're not saying, okay, strategically we're making decisions about this, this, and that. It's a shotgun approach. Plus, it's not going to work unless you increase those prices so much. And they're not going to devalue the yuan, you know, 10 to 1, 20 to 1, which is the ratio of labor costs. They're going to devalue the yuan by 5%, 10%, 15%. It's going to be nothing. It's not going to make any difference. But this is the, it's called monetary policy to affect trade policy rather than using tariffs. And it's stupid. But the Bush administration and Greenspan are pushing for it. And the Chinese now are pushing back. And they're saying, the more you talk about this, the longer it's going to take us to do it. We don't want to do it because we don't want our sales to drop. In fact, they said that the appreciation of the yuan could affect domestic jobs. That's their concern. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
And welcome back.
And I think to myself,
What a wonderful world. What a beautiful world. Every day we wake, every day I wake up breathing, I'm grateful. It's just life is such a gift, which all the more so makes me aware of the loss of life in Iraq, the deaths that have been caused by George Bush Jr. getting involved in this horrible war, getting us involved in this horrible, horrible war. Happy with a skyrocketing U.S. trade deficit, notes David Sirota. Pleased with more and more good-paying jobs being outsourced to cheap overseas labor markets. Thrilled that corporate patents and copyrights are protected on the international market, but not human rights, environmental regulations, or wage standards. Excited that corporations can use international trade organizations to undermine the sovereignty of your state. Well, then you're either a corporate executive or a business lobbyist working feverishly to make sure Congress votes against a resolution today. This House Joint Resolution number 27, that would force the United States to renegotiate unfair trade policies. It was voted down today. I don't have a list yet of who voted how. We're going to work on it, and we're going to get it. That's right, a bipartisan resolution. Actually, I'm sure it'll be all over the web. A bipartisan resolution scheduled to hit the floor today, and it did. Truly a critical vote. Will Congress continue taking its orders exclusively from corporate America and vote this measure down, even though polls show Americans want a new trade policy? No, they won't. I mean, yes, they will. They'll vote the measure down and continue to take their orders from corporate America. It is just so, so obvious. It is so tragic, really. Here we have General Motors. This is the big news, of course. GM cutting 25,000 jobs. And yet, the two stories behind the story. Number one, this is a failure of the management of GM to anticipate markets to the extent that they're not making sales figures. And secondly, if you look at the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, you see a chart that goes back to 1995 and back to Clinton in 96. You know, it's 95, Clinton signing NAFTA and GATT. And every year, the GM had 250,000 workers, and then it goes down to 225,000 and then 200,000 and then, you know, and all, you're just sliding down the scale here right up until today. Every year, they have been pairing American workers, and now they're putting Chinese motors in their cars? I mean, you know, this is an outsourcing story as much as it's a death of America story. It's welcome to conservative economics. Welcome to Reaganomics. Welcome to trickle-down economics. Welcome to the loss of the middle class. Thanks to George W. Bush and his friends. That's really what this is all about. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Take care.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.